episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Accessibility Collective's Content Creators and Accessibility Virtual Roundtable Panel. Oh my God, that's a lot of words. First, we'd like to acknowledge that UBC and CITR are located on unceded, ancestral, and continuously occupied land of the Musqueam, Tsleil-Waututh, and Squamish Nations.
And I'd like to acknowledge that I live and work within the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territory of the Siksik Nation here in Kelowna, BC.
It is so nice to see everyone here on Zoom, isn't it, Randy?
Hello, everyone. Yes, it's great to have this technology to bring us all together during this challenging time, and I'm happy to be wearing my fuzzy pink bunny slippers for this very special occasion.
Indeed, Randy. Well, my name is Anna, and I'm a third-year social work student here at UBC, and together with Randy, I'll be moderating today's event. Randy, tell us a little bit about yourself, too.
Thanks, Anna. I'm a freelance journalist and community support worker here in Kelowna, and I'm pleased to be part of this roundtable today about content creators with diverse abilities.
As a collective, we decided to organize this event to put a spotlight on creators with diverse abilities. As content creators with disabilities ourselves, we thought it might be interesting to chat about how the pandemic is affecting our fellow content creators. Isn't that right, Randy?
Yes, Anna, and now it's with great pleasure I'll ask our three panelists, to please introduce themselves. Can we start with you, please, Mike?
Hi, everyone. My name is Mike Beacom, also known as Broly Legs in the fighting game community. I am a professional fighting game player, mainly in Street Fighter. Travel the world, competing in the game. I've gone to many tournaments. And I'm also a book author of my own life. And currently, I also do teaching. I also teach players how to play the game to pass on my knowledge to the next generation. And I'm very happy to be here. So thank you so much, Randy and Anna, for inviting me over.
Thank you very much, Mike. And now, can we please welcome Velvet Crayon? And can you please introduce yourself, Velvet?
Hi, I'm Velvet Crayon. I'm a musician and performance artist. When COVID started, I realized I wasn't going to be touring the whole year. So I started streaming on Twitch, where I play music and video games, mostly platformers. And thanks for having me. I'm very excited.
And thank you. And now we're going to move on to Stefan. Stefan, would you please introduce yourself to everyone?
Hi, thanks very much for including me in today's event. My name is Stefan Sanandan-Hanish, and I'm a postdoctoral researcher in the Department of Theatre and Film at the University of British Columbia.
That is super cool. Thank you, Stefan. And now we will start, we will ask members of the Accessibility Collective who are also asking questions to introduce themselves. So we'll start with Monica.
Thank you, Anna. So I'm a member of the Accessibility Collective since January of last year, and I'm also a third-year physics student at the University of British Columbia.
Thank you, Monica. Jordan, would you like to introduce yourself too?
Yeah, my name is Jordan Waterston. I'm a third-year UBC student studying in English and computer science and intending to go into video game design in the future. And yes, I am a member of the Accessibility Collective.
That is awesome. And I love your background still. So now let's begin with our questions from the collective. So first questions will be for all three panelists. And so the first question is, in terms of accessibility and in the profession that you are all in, which is content creators, how has the pandemic affected things for you? Has it been challenging or beneficial to you? With COVID-19 and everyone having to stay home, do you think it is easier to get yourself out there as a content creator, or is it more difficult because there's so many people online, I guess? I guess we can start with Mike.
Okay. the pandemic has been really tough, especially on me, just because I do a lot of competition and competing, go to tournaments all over the country, go to Vegas for Evo, I go to Florida. 2019 was a year I went pretty much everywhere. It was my first time going to E3. And it's really been a struggle to not be able to go out and compete and show the world what I can do. Thankfully, there's things like Twitch that I can be streaming on there or on YouTube where I can show off my content from there. The reach from there is still, you know, pretty great because I could meet people from all over the world just with a click of a button. So that's always been great. But more or less, the pandemic has made it really difficult for us to really shine, especially for me, being able to go out because, sure, I could get online and play people, but not being able to see me and actually see how I can play, because I play with my face, with my mouth, it's more of a competition to get my name out there. But other than that, I'm still striving to do my best, and you know, with any challenge that comes in my way, I'm always looking for a way to overcome it. So it's been a struggle, but I'm doing the best, very best that I can.
Glad you're keeping your spirits up. It seems like the pandemic has really affected your industry and your particular style of content creator, which is, you know, competing in video games. Yeah. Which is like a tough sport. Yeah. So it is like, I used to play Pokemon Go, like battle the Pokemon, you know, and like, oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, it's a big competition and it's a one-on-one thing, and it's very stressful, very hard to do, but I love it. I'm a competitive person. I've always been that way. Even despite my disability, I've always been wanting to be the best. So I'm still like that. I'm still wanting to do that. Can't wait for this to all wrap up and hopefully get back into the tournament scene once again.
Sure, lots of our listeners can relate to being competitive. Crayon, how about you? How did the pandemic affect your particular industry?
Yeah, I had planned, I think, on traveling a lot in 2020, which is good and bad, you know. I tour a lot, and it's tiring. So when COVID happened, I had already thought about wanting to stream on Twitch, both music and video games, just because I play video games. And so when COVID happened, I just kind of was like, well, here's the excuse to not take a bunch of touring offers, which worked out well, I think. I think I've had an okay time with COVID, actually. I'm pretty introvert, which is funny as somebody who tours and goes on stage. I think things like that kind of draw introverts sometimes, though. So I kind of been okay with it. I think that I've seen a lot more people with disabilities being listened to during COVID. Maybe not by the government, of course, any government, of course. But definitely I've seen more of these panels. I didn't see these before COVID as frequently, where people were trying to give a voice to people with disabilities. So I think that's really interesting. And I don't know, it just proves that, like, we're a people that are separated, you know? We're all disabled in a way, and we're separated because it's a family that you're not born into, but you are, but you're not have that proximity. So yeah. I think now is the perfect time for COVID to happen in some weird way, because we have the internet and we can do this when we couldn't even do this 5 years ago. So I don't know.
It's a good point, you know, like I also noticed that people with disabilities, the voices like are being much more heard in the public.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And Stefan, how is it going for you with the pandemic?
Right. Thanks very much for the question. I think that in my own work, primarily when it comes to presenting talks and in teaching, it seems that there are increased opportunities for collaborative problem solving to try to work to figure out solutions to accessibility issues that sort of might arise in the moment, to managing multiple accessibility needs within the same learning environment. So in that sense, I think that there are opportunities that have certainly arisen, but I very much agree with what others have been sharing about some of the difficulties that are also involved. So that's all just to say that I think there are certainly pros and cons. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, like on the accessibility note, even like being on Zoom is such a huge accessibility positive for a lot of students, even at UBC. And now we'll move on to our next question. Thank you, everybody. That was super awesome. And I think it's Jordan who is asking the next question.
Thanks, Anna. So we're going the same order as well. So for our question, do you remember your first encounter with lack of accessibility? And what was it, and what did you do to try and overcome it? Start with Mike.
I've been competing in tournaments since 2004. And back then I had a wheelchair, but I didn't have a van to transfer my wheelchair. And I mean, back then I was kind of, you know, I was younger. I was, you know, in high school, and I was, you know, definitely weighed a lot less back then too. You know, back then we didn't care. I didn't care. I wanted to go to tournaments. I wanted to compete. And our usual carpool was 6 or 7 of us in a small car driving for 6 hours of the middle of the night. We didn't care because we didn't, you know, we didn't have money for a hotel, barely had enough money for the admission, and maybe food, maybe dollar menu McDonald's, and that was it. Hopefully if we won, we get to eat good. If we don't, we eat McDonald's, and that was it. But yeah, there was some tournaments there. Usually what I would request from a TO, and obviously I asked them beforehand, is for them to have like a table that I could just lay on and compete there, because I don't really stand up. The way I compete is I lay on my stomach and I have my elbows up and I have my little controller up to my face, and I compete that way. And so what I would ask them is to have a table by the setup so then I can play. And sometimes there was, you know, they would be able to do it, no problem. But one particular tournament, they couldn't, they didn't have it. And the tournament was actually at a bar. And so they had no tables. So I had to play on 2 bar stools next to each other, right? And I had to lay across it. Very troubling, very intimidating, because it was very, you know, they're not very sturdy. So, you know, one wrong motion, I could fall off. But again, back then, I didn't care. Honestly, my competitive spirit was, you know, just play, you know, I just want to play. As long as I can get in there and play, that's all that matters. I've had plenty of experiences like that. One time I had to be carried by my friends up 3, you know, stories high because there was no elevator in the place. Back then it was a really tough situation back then, because, you know, it wasn't expected for a player to come in with a disability, and, you know, it was very rare to find someone like that. So I felt like me being there and me being at tournaments like that allows tournament organizers and, you know, competition organizers to see that and say, you know, there's a need for this, to have a place that's more accessible so that players of, you know, nobody could be scared of going and saying, maybe I can't make it, maybe I can't go. I'm proud to be one of the first people that were able to. Obviously proud to have a lot of people that supported me, you know, my brother, my family, friends that were willing to carry me to these places, to these spots. And yeah, I'm still doing that even today. It's tough, even just going on an airplane and stuff like that. There's so many things that need to be perfect just for me to go and play. But I don't let those things slow me down. I keep going, keep trying to play, and hopefully make change happen so that other players after me that have disabilities, that have physical stuff, will not be deterred from entering competitions like that. So a very powerful thing for me early on in my age, but I'm proud to overcome it and continue doing what I love to do.
I really got to commend your drive. That's really, really inspiring, man.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we can go to Crayon next.
Yeah. I think when I first encountered lack of accessibility, I think it'd be my entire existence. Like the world, it's more about now, I think my attitude towards it has changed, you know, like the world is still inaccessible completely. I think digitally we're more accessible than we are physically, of course. But I think my attitude towards it has changed. So it's not my responsibility to overcome it. Like, I think that's the whole conversation, is that it shouldn't be my responsibility to overcome it. Like, I'm just trying to live as a human, and the world should overcome wanting to make things inaccessible, because I think that's an attitude I saw as a kid that I had as a kid even, that, you know, the world just hadn't caught up yet or something. And I think that's total crap. I think, especially now, in America, we've had the Americans with Disabilities Act most of my life, 30 some years. They've had time. They don't want to. It's clear. So it's not my responsibility to overcome it anymore. It's everyone else's.
I think it's not really my turn to push in, but I really appreciate that perspective of, like, yeah, I mean, yeah, you do. You obviously want to fight for your own rights or whatever, but to some extent, you can't put your entire emotional energy into that.
Like, I think that's with everybody, though, right? Like, you're just trying to survive as a human. I think everybody is just trying to survive as a human, and just that in itself. So we're all overcoming whatever, you know, and that idea. But accessibility should be more about the world catching up. But I think digitally, things are pretty a lot better. Like, I like Twitch because I'm responsible for it in that way. That with the idea of open source plugins that they allow, I think Twitch does a pretty good job.
Yeah, I totally agree with both of you. It's kind of, it reminds me, it kind of holds close to home with what happened in the States with George Floyd, but it's that same thing where it's that responsibility. Like, it's not your responsibility to overcome it. Like, the world should be putting these barriers up for you. So I think you're totally right in that. And we can go to Stefan.
Thanks very much. So I think, as with maybe several other participants thus far, I would have trouble identifying a single earliest experience of accessibility, and I have noticed recurring instances as a wheelchair user myself of barriers that seem to occur in fairly similar ways, but then my access needs tend to evolve. So I think that there's also that that dimension of a changing connection to a physical environment, for example, as the years go by. So I think that rather than identifying any one particular instance of an accessibility barrier early on, I would just perhaps, again, like other participants, draw attention to systemic access barriers, and ones that very often seem to manifest in similar kinds of ways.
Excellent, everyone.
Yeah, that, I don't know, like, you guys, because I also have accessibility issues because, you know, we're all in the collective, and yeah, it's basically that, I would say. So now let's just move on to Monica and our next question.
So our next question is, what adaptations to your content creation pipeline have you made due to the pandemic? And do you see these changes, if you made any changes, staying for the foreseeable future? So let's start with Mike again.
There's definitely adaptations that I have. I mean, I'm a gamer, and that's the main thing that I do as a content creator is teaching with the game, in a competitive format. I try to show myself, or view myself as a coach or as a teacher, as a tutor. Obviously, the things, the tools we have online, the technology that we have, I use, Skype, Discord, Zoom, to reach out to players from China, Japan, Thailand. It's not just America that I reach out to. I try to help others. My whole goal and message is, there are players out there that don't have someone to play and don't have anybody to practice with or to learn from, so they're stuck. And so I try to offer that service to them where they don't need to play by themselves. They don't need to ask and not have that question answered. Ask me and I can answer it. I don't know, in the sense of like adaptations, like I use a regular controller. I use an older controller, like an older console or generation controller. So I use a converter to play on the new ones because the new ones kind of aren't great for me. But I would guess, I would say as far as adaptation, I'm the one that makes the adaptations. I'm the one that tries to figure out what works, what doesn't with me. And see what helps. Yeah, I've been offered a lot of times, hey, can we build you a controller that would work for you? And I always say yes, but it seems like it's always very complicated. Nobody can really do it the way I want it to be. And I'm just like, I can do it. I'm able to do it. I've always been that way since I was a kid. I was trying to, I remember having OTs try to teach me how to use Dragon Dictate on the computer back in the early 2000s, which was a mess. And so I would, be there and all the time trying to learn off of that. And I just couldn't do it. I'd rather put a, pencil in my mouth. I'd rather type like that. I'd rather write like that. That's how I wrote my book. I didn't use anything to cite it because I felt like, hey, if I could do it, I'll do it. I don't mind it, because, that's what I've always been about. I've always been about not looking to find the sideway, even though nowadays, it isn't my responsibility. I should use these tools to take advantage. I'm just hard-headed and I'm stubborn, and I'd rather do things old-fashioned way, I guess. So I tend to look for things that are in my control, and when they're not, then I also obviously look for the alternatives. And definitely, especially in gaming, button configuration has been a big thing for me. There's games that a year ago I could never play. I couldn't even touch. And now the gaming industry has made strides to where there's button configuration in their systems, not just depending on the game itself or the developer themselves. Now the system has it. So it doesn't matter what game you're playing. As long as you can do it on the system, you're fine. So there's games that are like Resident Evil that I can play finally, not just, fighting games, things that I love that I would just kind of watch as a viewer. Now I don't need to be a viewer. I can actually do it on my own. In those aspects, I think being able to adapt to my surroundings and adapt to my situation allows me to enjoy things a lot better. And I'm really happy that I'm able to do that.
Changes I made because of the pandemic. Before I toured, so it was all about having the travel and lots of travel and taking what I do to people And since the pandemic, it's all just been, I'm in my room. Like, this is an extra room we have, and it's nice. I'm in pajamas, and it's comfy, and I get to do the same thing I would do on the road, except sleep in my own bed. That's pretty cool, and I get to play video games now. So I think I'm definitely going to keep doing it this way, because I think this way, even if I were to go back to touring, which I would like to do, I think streaming live shows has been so much more accessible than people having to come to venues. Everybody has a device, not everybody, but it's much easier to get access to watch something digitally than it would be to leave your home and go to a venue that you don't know what the accessibility is there. So yeah, even if I go back to touring, I want to live stream all my shows.
I mean, you know, like, the pandemic has done the same to education kind of thing. I'm like,
yeah, for in life, sure, yeah.
You know, like, it's very similar.
Yeah, I could never afford to have a live closed captioning person doing sign language. That's not something as an independent artist I could ever afford. But every program has live captioning. So, and most of the time it's right. Sometimes it's right, but it's getting better.
It's getting, you can make out the, you know, the general theme for sure.
It out. Yeah. Yeah.
And, Stefan?
I think that, for me, even before, COVID, I've been trying to incorporate, thinking about access in multidimensional ways into my research and teaching. And I think that going back to what we were discussing earlier, I think that there are opportunities that seem to be emerging for sort of collective problem solving and figuring things out sort of in the moment. And I'm hoping that once things perhaps resemble how they were before COVID, perhaps to a greater extent, then I'd like to retain as much as possible those opportunities for working more collaboratively to approach access and to learn things from others and refine certain things that seem to work well for addressing access needs.
Stefan, I am curious, like, we don't have it on the questions here. Do you feel like when you were doing graduate studies, like having these accessibility issues, your voice was less heard or it had more clout because of that?
That's a good question. I felt well supported by faculty and now as a postdoctoral researcher by my colleagues. And I think that, I should qualify that by noting that that's my personal experience. And I feel fortunate to have those kinds of support. I think that one of the challenges going forward, even in fairly recent articles and essays in the Chronicle of Higher Education or Inside Higher Education, for example, I think that there is an emerging recognition that a lot of online platforms, Canvas perhaps, and others, online learning systems, don't necessarily meet a full range of access needs. And I think that there is this emerging recognition that relying purely on individual accommodations in the classroom, for example, can end up sort of maintaining a level of burden on individual students and faculty to respond very quickly. And so perhaps one of the practices that hopefully could be sustained going forward is to expand individual accommodations with a more widespread and collective engagement in thinking about access.
That's a really interesting idea. Yeah.
I totally agree with it, like, so much. And yeah, we should probably, like, once the pandemic is over, we should all meet together on UBC campus and talk about that again. Yeah. So next question is from Richard.
Awesome. Thanks, Anna. So my question is, in terms of accessibility, have you done any advocacy work on promoting and bringing awareness on this issue that you'd like to let us know about? So we'll go with Mike first again.
Mainly the thing that I've brought attention to many places, because I go to, even though there's a lot of tournaments, aside from those tournaments, there's also conventions, there's meetings with different developers and, you know, indie gamer developers that come in and ask questions, and they allow us to play and test out their games and give feedback. One thing that I've always been a big proponent about is accessibility in gaming. Button configuration that I touched on earlier. It's one of the things that I've always struggled with as a child. I grew up playing every single console. I've been playing since I was 2 years old. I had an NES when I was two. My parents got me that. They didn't know what I would do with it, and somehow I was able to make it work, and I just grew up with it. But there was, you know, some struggles with controllers that I couldn't really play with. And sometimes my dad will go out and look for third-party controllers that maybe would, you know, benefit me or help me out. And there are some games that I just grew up that I couldn't play very well. I know one particular game when I was growing up is like Mario Kart. I couldn't do the shoulder buttons. I couldn't press L and R. I couldn't do the hops. So if an item's coming at me and it's gonna hit me, I have to take it because that's all that was there to do. There was no way to jump in. There was no way to go over it. But I kind of went with it. I kind of said, you know, I'm having fun, and I put fun over whatever struggle I had. As long as I was having fun, I was okay with it. If there was something that I couldn't play, then, you know, all shucks, I moved on, right? But I know now that it's important to not have that mentality of just saying, all shucks, never mind, when there's so many other people that really do want to enjoy this, experience it. And I've always been someone that says, hey, allow players to customize. Maybe they can only press these two buttons. We'll allow them to put those two buttons, whatever they want, because maybe it'll allow them to gain access to that game that they thought was impossible to play with. And it's just for their enjoyment to not be left out. I think that's one of the biggest things to feel as someone that is always looking for accessibility, is to not be left out. It's the worst feeling you can feel, because you just want to be a part of whatever is going on, whether it's going out with your friends, whether it's singing, whether it's going to a concert, whether it's enjoying a movie. You don't want to be that person that's left out because of inaccessibility. And even though it's just video games, and even though it doesn't seem as important, you can still feel left out if you're not accessed to that game that you want to play. So I think it's very important that developers have heard and that are striving to make those changes in gaming and allow players to have a general access to whatever game they make, have that idea, you know. And it doesn't have to be controllers. It could be you know, things for colorblind, things for captioning, for audio, anything that can allow a person that has issues or has a disability not be scared or not be worried that this game might not be for them. Because at the end of the day, we want all games to be for everyone. And that's what I've tried to push forward in my lifetime and continue to do so even today.
Awesome. Yeah, for sure. I totally agree. Totally agree. That's definitely really important. And thanks for pushing that issue and sharing your experiences with us. Mm-hmm. All righty. So next up is Crayon.
Yeah, I think I think my art in general is about advocacy, because I'm just me and I'm weird, and I do music, and music is just me, and the chair is part of it, a big part of it. But I also do performance art, which is cabaret work, which I for a long time was the whole thing was about, hey, this is me, and I'm on the stage, and I'm gonna force you to look at me, and maybe make you feel uncomfortable, because that's fun. And I think during COVID, I just allowed myself to, if an opportunity of a panel, I would never do one of these before COVID. I would much rather just be on stage performing. But during all this, I don't know, I just decided that it was okay to do these. I don't know why it wasn't before. But I just didn't feel like I had anything to say besides what was on stage before. And yeah, I've just allowed myself to do things like this.
Well, that's awesome. We're super glad you chose to get on our panel. We're super, super happy to have you and for you to share your experiences. Awesome. So last but not least, we have Stefan.
Thanks very much. So in terms of accessibility advocacy, I think that as just my response to a previous question, and trying to connect to what others are saying, I think that accessibility advocacy now is increasingly something that I try to fold into all aspects of my research and teaching and so forth, to the point that I think that I try to find ways to promote and bring awareness to accessibility in however I show up and wherever I show up. So if it's working as part of a committee or presenting a guest lecture and so forth, I think that I would find it hard to think about accessibility advocacy as somehow a separate aspect of what I do in my work.
Yeah, you know, I'm studying to be a social worker right now, and it's kind of similar. I'm trying to actually bring, you know, like the disability aspect, you know, and talking about accessibility with other social workers. So I think it is almost time to start with some audience questions, which is fun. Yes. And so who, I think it's Jordan, who is going to read the first audience question.
All right, let me just pull it up here. Sorry, my computer's all over the place. So for the first audience question, for those who stream, what is your setup like? What mic, camera, capture card, software, etc. do you have? And we can go in the same order.
Yeah, I do a lot of streaming. I'm not a good streamer though, but I'm okay. But I just actually got the I think it was like the Elgato, the new one, like the 60 plus one. I don't even know the name of it. I'm not. But it's like one of the newer ones. I got a Snowball mic. It's just kind of like a small standard one. Because I don't know, for some reason I was always like, I don't want those arm ones. I just, it's not for me, I guess. But I use that. I stream off of a laptop. This laptop's kind of old. It's an MSI 2017 type. I got one. This is actually one that I got from Maple Gamers. Because I didn't even have, I had a laptop and it was breaking down. And I was like, man, I want to stream. And so they were able to help me get this and, you know, hook me up with it. So it was really, really great on them. But yeah, I mean, this is, you know, I try to aim for good quality. I'm always in the mind of like, I'd rather be more content than, like, you know, quality over like my content, me being the entertaining one. But I also don't want it to look bad. So I try to keep up as much as possible. But yeah, I mean, it's just pretty up-to-date stuff, or I try to be as up-to-date. I think I do need a new mic and camera. But yeah, this is my setup, and been doing it for, I think, 7 years now. But I still don't think I'm a good streamer, but still, I do my best.
Very cool.
I think you're a good speaker.
I think so too. Like, I think you're doing a fantastic job right
now. Yeah, you're doing great, man.
We have evidence. We have evidence for this.
Yeah, I've always been, I don't know, I wanted to be a speaker, and then I was always in my shell when I was a kid or growing up. And so I think teaching people Street Fighter has been something that's helped me, because I literally just opened myself up to a new student and be like, hey, this is me, I'm your teacher, what do you want to know, right? What do you want to learn? And a part of it is also selling it. Like, I also have to sell to them, do you want to keep doing this? Do you want to keep being my student? Do you want to keep, you know, quote unquote, paying me to teach you? So I was not a very social person growing up. And I think going to tournaments and doing this has opened that up for me. So I appreciate the compliments. Thank you, guys.
Well, we're always here to compliment, you know, people who deserve it. Sarah, would you like to ask the next audience question? Or, yeah? Yeah? Oh. Okay.
Me and my banana are excited too. For Stefan, how do you feel about the representation of disability within theater and film?
Thanks for the question. So my own background is actually in music, my research interests in disability studies align with my postdoc supervisors. I can't necessarily comment extensively about the representation of disability in theater and film specifically, but I think that to respond perhaps in a rather general way, I think that there are perhaps similarities between the representation of disability in theater and film, and then in my own field of music. Perhaps a sense in which similar kinds of questions about representation tend to arise. So the reliance on overcoming narratives, for example, in theater and film, and then also in various ways in how disabled musicians are discussed in the media, in literature, in scholarly research as well. And disability studies and critical disability studies approaches push back against all of that. So I should also perhaps note that there's, of course, change over time in any discipline. So I think that the forms of representation that might have been prevalent several decades ago aren't necessarily the same ones that exist now. And there are new lines of critique and new methods of research and so forth that are continually evolving, which then, of course, give rise to new questions. So maybe just to sort of round off my response, I think that in cultural and artistic and musical representations of disability and of people with disabilities and creative practices by people with disabilities, I think that the ground is continually shifting in sometimes productive ways. There can be frustrating moments when it seems like things aren't changing fast enough. And so certain cliches, for example, tend to reappear. But I think that it's I think also that the particular moment that we're all experiencing with COVID is also perhaps several participants earlier were commenting on things like going to movies, attending concerts, and the particular kinds of barriers that might be involved in doing those sorts of activities. And I think that maybe just to round off my response on a positive note, I think that because new technologies allow for participation in the arts, for example, in virtual COVID-safe ways, I think that that's also becoming part of larger conversations about the representation of disability in the performing arts.
That was insanely insightful, and I appreciated that response so much.
Indeed, it was very insightful. I'm like, yeah. I was like literally taking notes.
I know.
Because I'm writing a paper on a similar topic. I'm like, I'll just take the notes. Yeah. So thank you for that, Stefan. Mm-hmm. And we have a Zoom chat question for Crayon. People are curious, what's your streaming setup looks like, but there is no pressure.
Yeah. My streaming setup is all over the place. I used to stream on a netbook when I first started streaming. And then I used my COVID check to buy a computer. But the mic I'm using is from like 2003. And I don't know what it is. I've recorded every record I've ever made with it. So I think setups aren't always, like, if you're in the streaming, and I think people ask this sometimes because they want to do it themselves, but they're nervous about it. And I don't think you need much. Like, I streamed the NES, like, emulator on a netbook for the first couple months of streaming, and it worked. It was buggy at times, but it was fun, and it worked. And I think you upgrade when you can with things you want. Like, I wanted a nicer camera. So I did that. But actually, it's my 1 year streaming anniversary on Thursday. So, yeah, thanks. And yeah, I just used a webcam. I have no idea what it is. It was on sale on Amazon.
Yes, sale on Amazon. Yes.
My mic is similarly sale on Amazon. I have no idea what it is. But
yeah, I don't think that super matters, as long as, you know, you have Ethernet. That's probably the most important.
The throughput matters. Yes.
Yeah.
Content that matters at the end of the day.
Definitely, that's for sure.
Yeah, we're forgetting. Monica, would you like to ask the next question from the audience?
Yes. So this question is specifically for Mike. How has the culture of EVO, or EVO, not sure, I'm not a gamer, changed over the years from your perspective?
EVO, yeah. It's for Evolution Gaming, I think, or Evolution Championship. I've been going since, I want to say 2011 was the first time. I've heard of it beforehand. It's been going on for a while before that. I started off playing in Smash, and Smash wasn't in Evolution. It was more of like the traditional fighting games, right? Street Fighter and Tekken and stuff like that. And so I finally went in 2011 when I got into Street Fighter, you know, wanted to test my mettle and see how I would do. And people were, you know, didn't know me back then. It's crazy, looking at a time period back then, when there was very little video and it was all forums and typing and, you know, murmurs and whispers and myths of like, oh, this player, this guy from Texas that plays with his face. And people were just like, no way, like that's not real. And like when they see, you know, for the first time, when I go into, when I enter a tournament, when they see me for the first time, I think that was the thing that drove me the most, was seeing the reaction for the very first time. When they got to see me play, when they saw me pull up right next to them and say, you know, you're my opponent, and I know a lot of times, especially in the early stages of competitive gaming, everyone thought I was easy. Everyone thought the term in the fighting game community is free. You know, when someone's free, you know that they're easy to win, or like that this is a no match. You know, like they, it's an easy win. So I'm pretty sure a lot of people considered me as an easy win in the beginning until they actually saw me play. I always, you know, tell people I don't enter tournaments unless I think I'm going to win, or if I think I'm very competitive or I'm capable of winning, right? I don't try to enter a tournament just for the experience. I try to I always take things to heart and try to compete as much as I can and do the best I can, because again, I'm a very competitive person. I love competing. It's in my blood. It's in, you know, I've always been that way. Heck, even when I was in high school, I wanted to put football pads and just play, even though I knew I couldn't do that. But, you know, the coach was like, no, you're going to get hurt. I knew that, but I still wanted to go out there and play. But it's changed. It's definitely changed a lot. Nowadays, it's like, you know, you got streams, you got video, you got recordings, you got YouTubes of matches. People see you. And they almost see you almost every day. They get a glimpse of your life whenever you stream, and they become a part of you. I've had so many friends that I met over streaming. I've met so many people there. They've gotten to know me. They got to know things that most people don't know, like, you know, what's my favorite food, or, you know, what I like to enjoy watching, what I like to enjoy playing, and things like that. And so the shock has kind of disappeared a little bit. I mean, obviously I put my hard work into it. I made a name out of for myself, or I try to be. You know, I'm not someone that's blows myself up. I still don't think I'm any good. I still don't think I'm anywhere near, like, you know, the top players and stuff like that. But I do know that, you know, people come up to me more and say, hey, can I have your autograph? Or hey, you know, I've heard about you, or keep being inspiring. And I try to shake it off, because at the beginning or at the end of the day, I just want to compete. My thing isn't to inspire. My thing isn't to be this symbol. It's just I'm just here to win. I just want to be the best. But I understand it, and I understand the responsibility and the role that I've been taking because of it, and what my message supports and what it means to people to not quit, to not give up, no matter how hard it is to play and to compete as like everybody else wants to compete. So it definitely has changed from a, you know, who is this person? What, you know, is this even guy even real, to, hey, I know who that guy is. I've seen that person play. He's really great. He's on ESPN. He's on big time streams and stuff like that. So I have enjoyed the ride. I've enjoyed the road from the beginning to now, and I just want to keep doing it. I'm in love with it, and I don't want to stop until, you know, the wheels fall off, like literally. So yeah.
Wow, Mike, your enthusiasm is so infectious. I just,
thank you.
You're just blowing me away, man.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Randy.
My next question is from our audience, from Lydia, and it doesn't say who it's for, so I'm gonna go with Stefan. Stefan, any media that you're really into right now that features disability and disabled artists, for example, things on Netflix or, you know, podcasts, things like that?
I think that for me, I'm following, for example, Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. I believe they're based in the U.S., and Sins Invalid, a performing arts group also based in the States and led by disabled people of color. And they center ideas about disability justice. And so I think that in terms of what is really inspiring me and helping me to learn, and expand my own thinking and my own practices, I would point to those organizations in particular. Some more also within academia, for example, the Canadian Journal of Disability Studies, and public-facing academic work as well, that's also taking place increasingly across a variety of media platforms.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
If you haven't seen Crip Camp on Netflix, it's very good. It's a very good Crip film. And I would highly suggest a book. A friend of mine wrote it, so that's kind of messed up that I'm familiar, but I don't care. It's called Sitting Pretty, and it's a very good book about the disabled experience, and I think it's worth the read. Yeah, it's called Sitting Pretty, yeah.
Did I spell it right?
Yeah, yeah. The author is Rebecca Taussig. I can write it in the chat.
Thanks. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Also, to kind of go with the Stefan's answer, if you're looking for ASAN in Canada, they're indeed American, but Autistics United is the Canadian version of that, basically. Okay, so now we'll go with the next audience question. And Jordan, would you like to present the next audience question?
Yes, I would. So this question is from Dora. Obviously, COVID has affected / stalled touring in general, but how have the use of digital platforms opened up the idea of touring as a disabled creator? I'm guessing that's targeted towards Crayon, so take it away.
Can you repeat it one more time? I'm sorry. I was writing in chat and I...
Yeah, sure. So obviously COVID has affected / stalled touring in general, mm-hmm. but how have the use of digital platforms opened up the idea of touring as a disabled creator?
Yeah, I think not every disabled performer can travel. I think even myself, who did travel a lot, it was getting hard on my body, and I miss sleeping in my bed. And now I think doing it all digital is still new to me, so it's like rebuilding an audience again on a totally different idea. So I think it's opened up more, though, because I know personally I've gone to more shows during COVID than I would have, like, just as a viewer, than I would have otherwise, because I could sit on my couch and do it. And I think that's true for a lot of people. And it's just harder. I don't know. I don't even know that it's harder to find shows. Like, there's so many bands that I'm into that I'm like, oh, they're doing a show all the time now, and I can watch it, and that's cool. And I don't have to worry about, like, can I pee at this venue? And because that's, you can't pee at most venues. And so for me, I really like the idea. I want to tour more. I'm doing a Minecraft festival. Like, I never thought that would be a thing. Like, I'm playing a show in Minecraft. Like, it's awesome. And it's an opportunity I wouldn't have had if it weren't digital. Like, the bands that are on it, I would not be playing alongside if it weren't digital, I think. So yeah, I think it's opened up a lot. I think I'm really excited to see. I hope people keep doing it. Like, I really do. Like, I don't know. I think some of the coolest art I've ever seen has been made during COVID. And it's accessible. And that's cool. And I hope it remains. Yeah.
Yeah, also, like, a lot of panels, like you mentioned, with the bands, and now you can just go and see them. Like, I found so many panels like this discussing so many, like, important issues that, you know, I could attend too. And also, like, my disability doesn't allow me usually sometimes, you know, to be in crowded places a lot of mm-hmm. the time. And this has been so good for that.
Yeah, for sure.
So our next question, Sarah, would you like to find the next question from our Slido?
The audience is tossed up between two, but I personally want to know Dora's question. Live streaming shows and competitions, do you feel like you're able to make money through streamed events, or have you been producing mostly for free? I guess it'd be for Crayon and Mike, right? Because you guys Twitch. Or do it, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm not making the money I would have been if I were on tour, but I think that's because it's new. And I think there definitely is ways because it's the punk rock. I come from punk rock shows, and that was my early beginnings as Velvet Crown was punk rock shows, and you didn't get paid at those shows, and you didn't pay to get in, but people are more willing to tip you if they didn't have to pay to get in. And yeah, I think Twitch has made that easy in that way. Yeah. So I think it's possible, but I'm not there yet.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much similar. To me, I mean, I do Twitch. I'm partnered on Twitch. Obviously, I mean, it's not something that I expect. It's not like I make a lot of money off of it. I stream more for the enjoyment of it and to show people what I can do. More, you know, than to say, hey, give me your money. But you know, I go on YouTube. I produce things on there. I actually, you know, do a lot of teaching courses on there, lessons on there to help those, and it's not someone to pay me. No one's paying me to do it. I just do it because I felt like doing it and want to help the next community. Sure, I advertise my coaching website on there or the team that I joined on there so that, you know, if they're interested, they could pay me to teach them. But I'm always an advocate of telling people, like, whenever I stream and I'm streaming Street Fighter and I'm playing, I always tell people, ask me questions. This is your time right now to ask me questions, because I always interact with the chat. I'm always talking to people. I'm always telling them, hey, you know, do this, do that. You know, and I obviously do incentives when they sub to the channel. I tell them, hey, I do replay analysis. I'll play you a first to three right here, a first to three games on stream and give you some feedback. So I always try to give back more than anything whenever I do something for money or something like that. But most of the time, I'm not expecting it. I'm just more of like, hey, this is cool. I'll stream when I have time and when I have fun. I don't force it. I don't consider it a job. If I consider it a job, then I probably put way more focus into it. At the moment, it's just a hobby and it's something that I love to do. And it gets me to meet new people and maybe make different connections. So that's what I treat it as. And that's what's cool about it.
Do you think, because you do YouTube and Twitch, right? Like you do both of them. Do you think, personally, I felt that Twitch is way more likely to make money on, like, because that's the question. It's way more likely. YouTube, I cannot make a penny on YouTube. You have to have so many views and everything. The algorithm is way harder on you than I think it is on Twitch if you're starting out. I don't know if you found that to be true.
Right, no, I mainly do Twitch. I do, yeah. YouTube, but I kind of dump my archived videos from Twitch, sure, to YouTube just to kind of have something there. I'm not partnered on YouTube or anything like that. I don't make money off of it. I made it kind of like a goal, like a New Year's resolution to try to do it there. But again, it's more of like I've put all my what I've been doing is this last this year, every month I try to tackle an RPG that I've never beaten before. And because I love the RPGs and stuff like that. So I post all my walkthroughs or all my playthroughs from there to my YouTube so that people can go back and look at them and say, part one. Like, this is the first time I actually started doing in parts, and I'll actually like make a good description of where we're at in the story and have a good summary so people can like tune in and be like, oh, I wanted to see this part or something. So it's very experimental. I'm lazy, so.
I think it's tricky, too, like, because I know as somebody, I intake a lot of media, mm-hmm, and I want the artists I like to get my money. Like, I want them to get my money, you know? It's I'd rather it go to them, and there's movements, like, as a musician, it is... Like, I have all my music on Spotify, and I love Spotify. I make nothing from Spotify. They give you a fraction of a penny per play. And I think a lot of digital resources are that way, and abusing content creators in that way.
Yeah. I've been approached to like, or asked to make like a Patreon or something, like,
yeah,
to do replay analysis there, or to, you know, to have people subscribe so that they can get their stuff to, I don't know. I mean, I also work and stuff, and like, if I had to go to it, then I would, but I'm just more of like, it's kind of like you, like if people want to tip me and give me money, great. I'm not really like going to look for it, you know, but maybe one day when I feel motivated to, I guess. I don't know. I just want to entertain and beat people up in Street Fighter. That's all. So I'm just too competitive to care. Yeah.
And just that's for awesome. Context, the audience member that asked that, Dora, I don't know much about them, but they're like deep into the music, like radio station stuff. So they were probably curious for their own.
A big thing for that is Bandcamp has been amazing during COVID, and Bandcamp Fridays, which they give 100%. If I sell an album on a Bandcamp Friday, I get all the profit from it. And Bandcamp doesn't even take a cut. And I think certain businesses during COVID have shown that they want to try to help artists. And I think Twitch is one of them. And I think, like, I was affiliate my first stream on Twitch because of a program they made for out-of-work artists during COVID. And they made it so you could immediately be affiliate and take donations and whatever. So it's if you really like an artist, you can find out what their preferred platform is, if that makes sense.
I have a question, Stefan, personally. Sure. I'm not an audience member, but I was wondering, so I'm kind of making my way through academia as well, and I was wondering how you found like finding a professor, like how you found all those steps that are normally, I guess the normal graduate school steps, but with in the way that you live.
Right. That's an excellent question. And I think that, I did my graduate studies in the music department at UBC for my master's, and then for my PhD, I did my studies also at UBC in education. And I just mentioned that to signal that I do have some experience navigating different faculties and departments. And I think that for me, what has often been the most successful approach, and also in some ways the most necessary approach, is to make sure that I'm reaching out in multiple directions proactively, and as soon as I anticipate needing certain kinds of support. For example, I recall meeting with two professors when I started my master's studies at UBC to figure out which practice rooms might be accessible, which performing spaces within the music school might afford certain easier kinds of navigation, and then also which performing spaces might be a little bit more difficult. And so meeting with them beforehand, before classes started, before the semester got underway, really was helpful. I think both for myself and then also for the faculty to have some sense of what my needs might be. And then also the Center for Accessibility is a really valuable resource. And that's all just to say that I think that what has worked for me in terms of this sort of, I guess, typical steps on the path towards getting a graduate degree or successive graduate degrees does involve a kind of not to keep returning to the same word, proactive, but something like a proactive approach that involves my identifying what I might need, not only what I'm likely to need based on past experience, but things that I might need sort of conceivably in the way of access supports, and then just reaching out through multiple channels sort of simultaneously well before the need is likely to arise. I think in that way, it sort of becomes easier for multiple potential resources and contacts to reach out, and then also for them to reach out to their networks in case they also might need help to support my access needs.
Yeah, that's really cool. You must be the master of navigating through people.
Yeah, your answers are so thorough.
Yeah, no, there's no question.
like I was taking notes again because like I'm also going through the same academic situation as Sarah, so you know. And so we have our last audience question, and we will ask the top question that got the most thumbs up on our Slido. And the question is to Crayon, what inspires your craft? Your music and all-around style are quite unique. So I'm interested, who was anonymous, in what your thought process is like behind your work.
I don't know what I'm doing. I have no idea. I've never known. I don't know. I've always said I like to make people laugh. And I think some of my favorite serious films are funny though, but they're serious. My process is completely random, and I don't know. I'm a very indecisive person. But I've as I've gotten older, it's been a focus of children's stories, the essence of a children's story that I think a really good children's story is loved by everybody, like adults. It's simple enough that a kid could understand it because it's primal. It's I don't know. Have you guys seen the cartoon Primal? This is the weirdest thing. It's one of the bloodiest cartoons I've ever seen.
Is it like Happy Tree Friends almost?
What?
Is it like Happy Tree Friends?
No, it's a silent cartoon made by the guy that did Samurai Jack. And it's about a caveman and a dinosaur. And I bring it up because the essence to me is it is a children's story. It's so violent. So it's primal. It's about these minds that haven't developed to our brains yet, but they're expressing such emotion, such a pure way that I think you could put it on for a kid and they would completely understand it in the same way that an adult would. And I think that's really cool. And I think I want my stuff to be like that, but I don't think kids should intake anything I do. Yeah.
I totally get it. I make sculpture, but it's like soft sculpture. So it's basically like creepy toys. Mm-hmm. So yeah, on the child front, I get it.
yeah, I think.
Yeah. So like the essence of like the children's toy or story, like because it's so condensed and so well articulated.
Yeah.
You know, but for adults and everybody else.
For sure, yeah. I agree completely. I think laughter is such a primal emotion. Is that an emotion? Reaction? I just want to make people laugh, but maybe make them think, but not too hard, because it's all supposed to be fun, you know? I want to ask you, Stefan, in relation to that, I know you play piano, yeah, right? I Googled during this a bit. But you're also a composer, and what do you still enjoy playing as much as you enjoy composing?
Yeah, so I actually haven't written anything for a while. I'd like to get back into that Doing research and teaching takes up probably most of my time now. I also haven't played piano for a while, but that's been a much shorter time. So that's all just to say that I very much enjoy both composing and playing the piano. Of course, now with COVID, the opportunities for collaborative music making are not available. I think also that President Santa Ono's, for example, the performances that he does remotely, both by himself and then also with members of the UBC community, perhaps offer a really helpful way of thinking about new kinds of collaboration that can happen. So that there's this wonderful blend of familiar music, let's say, made in unfamiliar ways. I think that going forward, I'd like to also sort of find ways to incorporate that into my own musical practices.
Terrific. I'm so thankful for all these great responses, and I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but unfortunately we're starting to run out of time. I could certainly probably sit here for another couple of hours and engage with you, and let's hope we can do this again someday, not too far down the road. In closing, again, I just want to thank everyone, and I want to thank the panelists. I want to thank our participants, our audience. I want to thank the collective. I want to thank my host, Anna, as well. In closing, I've got one question here, which is for all of you, everyone, panelists, collective, and certainly our audience. And it's what was asked, but for us all to stop and think about, and that is, how difficult will it be for you in the future to manage online and in person once COVID is gone? What's going to change? What are we going to reflect upon from all of this? How are we going to grow and move forward? So thank you very much. And over to you, Anna.
Yeah, I would like to also thank everybody. It's been fantastic. And, you know, thank you, Crayon. Great job. Thank you, Mike. Mike, you should definitely pursue public speaking. It might be your calling. And thank you, Stefan. And I hope to meet you on UBC campus next year so we can discuss disability and accessibility issues at UBC and research in that area, because I'm super interested in it. And great. So now we'll just close the show, I guess, like the usual way we do. So if you are interested to join in joining our team, or think there are issues we should bring up in our show, please send us an email at accessibilitycollective@citr.ca.
Please like our All Access Pass on the Facebook page.
If you're on Twitter or Instagram or both, please follow access_CITR. If you missed this part of our live show today and want to listen again, or maybe want to listen to our past episodes, you can do so by going to citr.ca, clicking on the search button, and typing in All Access Pass.
Hmm.